Tuesday, June 11th. Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arents. Before we jump into the show that we had planned for today, we want to address the breaking news this hour. A jury in Delaware has found Hunter Biden guilty on 3 felony charges. And with us now on the line is Matt Visor, a reporter from The Washington Post. He's their White House correspondent. Matt's been covering this trial and I believe is with the president right now. Matt, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Matt, the verdict is guilty. Break this down for us because it wasn't a huge surprise. What's your reaction?
So, yeah, there are 3 counts that he's guilty on, all related to buying and owning a gun at a time when the jury found that he was addicted to drugs and so lied on a gun form in order to purchase that gun. So it was somewhat expected. I mean, given the course of how this trial unfolded over the last week, but still a historic moment, the first time a son of a president has been found guilty of a federal crime. It's a dramatic moment for the Biden family and for the president himself, who's just released a statement reacting to the news, saying that he'll stand by his son and support him as he appeals this verdict.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to see that statement yet, Matt. It's just sort of a generic stand by his son statement. Anything more in there that we could glean?
So President Biden has been a little bit reluctant to weigh in too forcefully on this. He wants the Justice Department to do its business and to not be seen as meddling in it. But he put out a statement before the trial began and now putting out another one as it ends. He talks about addiction and families struggling with addiction, just like his own has with his son's struggles with addiction. And then he says that he'll accept the outcome of the case and continue to respect the judicial process as Hunter continues an appeal, and that Jill and him will always be there for Hunter and the rest of his family will, and nothing will change that. So a lot of it is very personal, but he is also kind of trying to instill faith in the Justice Department and respecting the decision that this jury of 12 people in Delaware, his home state, came to this conclusion. So there is a little bit of a contrast I think he's trying to make with President Trump as this verdict will enter the presidential political arena.
Yeah, and I understand First Lady Dr. Jill Biden was with Hunter Biden today when that jury verdict came down. So what does this verdict actually mean for Hunter Biden? What are the next steps?
So the next steps are sentencing. So the jury does not play a role in what sentence Hunter will get for this crime. They have given the crime. They have said that he committed this crime. And now it's up to the judge to determine a sentencing. So the judge has 120 days to do that. So it will come sometime in the next few months. But the sentencing guidelines on this, it's up to 10 years in jail. But Hunter's team and legal experts expect him to get way less than that. He's a first-time offender. He had the gun for only 11 days. There was no crime that he committed. There were no violent acts with it. So his team is hoping for something along the lines of probation rather than jail time. But that's going to be up to the judge, who ruled several times against Hunter Biden's legal team throughout this case.
And before we let you go, Matt, typically, we would think that if the sitting president's son is convicted of federal charges, it would hurt his reelection campaign. And yet this comes at the very time that the other side, President Trump and his surrogates, are saying that the Biden administration has weaponized the justice system. And this verdict and Biden's unwillingness to pardon his son does seem to cut against that argument. So what do you think the political fallout will be?
It's an amazing question. There's a personal aspect to this that is very damaging for the president, but unmistakably, there's also a political aspect of this that is not so damaging to him. He can now make the case that his Justice Department is so independent that it just prosecuted his son and charged him with 3 federal crimes. And so I think you'll start to hear that argument a little bit. I think the president will maybe not personally make that argument just because it's so personally complicated for him, but I think Democrats will try to make the case that, you know, that this is a Justice Department that is independent, despite what former President Trump has been saying about its weaponization.
Fascinating. Well, yeah. That is Matt Visor, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. And thanks for joining us on super short notice, Matt. We really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wow. Well, big news today.
Big news. And I'm sure we'll have more on this as the weeks and the months go on. But let's get into what we were planning to do today, Cherry. Mm-hmm. And today we're going to talk about driving safety.
Yeah.
That's really the whole show today, because there have been two recent developments in Pennsylvania/Philadelphia. Statewide, a new law about distracted driving. Someone can now pull you over. An officer can now pull you over if you are using your cell phone while driving. And then here in Philadelphia, there is a push to really expand the use of speed cameras on major arterial roadways in the city. And so we're going to talk about both of those things today in tandem, because there is this larger push to try to reduce traffic fatalities, which have been on the rise locally and nationally.
Yeah. And how do you feel? Do you see distracted driving happening all the time? I know I do. Do you feel a certain kind of way about speed cameras? Do you have bad driver pet peeves that you want to share with us? Give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And we have a whole list of folks that are going to be weighing in on the show later today.
And we just talked about the news with Hunter Biden, and we're going to start now our news roundup with something that relates to another recent conviction, this one involving former President Trump.
Yes.
Cherry, go ahead.
Yes. Former President Donald Trump's recent conviction in New York has some ripple effects. Now, New Jersey's Division of Alcoholic Beverage Control, which is part of the state's attorney general's office, they are looking into whether that conviction now makes Trump ineligible to hold liquor licenses in the Garden State. Now, Trump holds licenses at three of his golf courses in New Jersey. Folks in our listening area, they may be familiar with the one in Pine Hill. It's called the Trump National Golf Club Philadelphia. Well, according to state law in New Jersey, it prohibits anyone from holding a liquor license who has been convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude. Now, this goes into
moral turpitude.
Yes. Part of what goes into
the last remaining use of turpitude. We found it.
It is a very legal East term, but part of what goes into that calculation is a requirement that a person must have a reputable character and would be expected to operate a liquor license or a licensed business in a reputable manner. And so the question is whether a crime involving dishonesty, meaning with the fraud, the record, fraudulent records charges, whether that is a crime of moral turpitude, which relates to dishonesty, fraud, or depravity. So there you go.
I am curious how dependent golf courses in general are on liquor licenses. I would think pretty dependent.
It does seem like and every time I've gone out there, there's been some liquor involved. Yes. I'm just going to full disclosure.
Yeah, I do think it's a pretty drinky kind of sport.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that if those licenses are revoked, it could be pretty damaging for Trump's assets in the region. So we'll keep our eye on that. Speaking of drinks.
Yes.
This time, hot drinks.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a fan of coffee or union politics, you're going to want to listen to this story that evolved
recently.
That
affects a lot of people.
It sure does. So OCF Coffee House is a business, I should say was a business, with three locations in Philadelphia. It's owned by this real estate firm called OCF. And the coffee houses were kind of like almost like advertising for the real estate business, just a way to sort of interact with people in a retail setting. Well, they're all closing. And that is because, or it seemingly is because, the workers at these OCF coffee houses in Philadelphia attempted to unionize. Here's the timeline. June 3rd, not long ago, 8 days ago, 23 workers presented the guy who runs OCF and OCF coffee houses, Ori Feibusch, with a letter asking that he recognize their budding union. Very shortly thereafter, he called a meeting and said, basically, I'm shutting down the coffee business. Mm-hmm. It wasn't profitable anyways. It's not really our main business. And now with this, the costs associated with this unionization effort, we just can't do it anymore. shutting them all down. It does have people pretty worked up because, like, first of all, they were popular coffee.
Yeah, I was a regular at the Fairmont location.
It's a big location right there on Fairmont Avenue. So they were popular. So people are worked up because of that, but also because of this, you know, the union politics and the back and forth at play. You got any thoughts on this?
Well, 45 employees will now be without a job.
Yep.
You know, Fibusha said, you know, he will provide them with health care for 3 months and some of them will get severance. But I mean, I mean, this isn't the first coffee house that when folks decided that they wanted to unionize, the company said we're going to close. I mean, Starbucks is dealing with the fallout of 23 locations closing at the end of last year, following baristas saying that they wanted to unionize. And so, you know, the question is, you know, are they tied? You're not supposed to close because of that. Are there real reasons? And now there's going to be, I think the local 80, the baristas union, is now going to do some protesting of the closure. And so
it's an unusual circumstance,
it is an unusual circumstance.
Coffee was not the main business at OCF, right?
Yeah.
Like, they can lose that and still go about, you know, developing properties, renting properties, selling properties. They're in the real estate business in many different ways.
Yeah.
So it is an unusual kind of circumstance. But it shows, again, that the coffee business and sort of America's debate about unions, for some reason, they keep colliding recently, like over and over and over again. It's surprising, right? Imagine telling that to someone 40 or 50 years ago, that barista unionization would be a hot topic. But I think it really has become one.
It really has. And they were getting paid $20 to $25 an hour.
According to OCF.
That's according to OCF. So, yeah, I definitely feel like this is going to be an issue that keeps coming up. Another issue that keeps coming up, Avi, is retail theft. We've talked
retail
about this
theft
on the show. And now local retailers or a retailer in America, they're taking some steps. Employees will soon be donning body cams at TJ Maxx, Marshall's, or Home Goods stores, possibly near us. We don't know. But body cams, and I'm talking about the kind that police wear, they will be used by workers at these retailers. And the goal is to curb retail theft as well as violence. And the parent company of TJ Maxx, TJX, they say that body cams are a way to de-escalate tension since people are less likely to do something violent when they're being videotaped. The National Retail Federation says the root cause of all of this has been these organized retail crime rings that steal items and illegally resell them through online marketplaces. And retailers
don't they already have cameras in the store.
They
though?
Do, but they I guess they're saying that, you know, they've been doing a lot of things. Like, they got rid of the self checkout. They started locking up more expensive items. They have now, I know I go to some of these retail chains, you can only get out one way. And the guy is like looking at you when you leave.
Yeah.
So they're trying to deter theft. And so this is just another way they're hoping to stem, you know, clamp down on violence and get, you know, and to stop people from stealing. So, yeah, but this type of body cams
Mexico,
are being used outside of the U.S. more than in the U.S.
Do
I think
they
in
work?
The U.K.
We'll have
jury's
to
still out.
Jury is still out. Started with juries, ended with juries, apparently, in this segment. So coming up, we're going to get into the meat of our conversation today. Road safety.
Yeah.
We're going to start with a conversation about distracted driving. That's the next segment. And then after that, a segment on speed cameras and other types of enforcement meant to sort of automatically monitor what you're doing on the road. So those are the two segments today. But the common theme is safety on the roads. What can be done? A ton of comments already coming in. Please keep sending them. Studio2@whyy.org. We will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro signed a law last week that makes it a primary offense to hold a cell phone or other electronic devices while driving. The law is named after Paul Miller, a then 21-year-old Pennsylvania resident who was killed by a tractor-trailer driver in 2010.
His mother, Eileen Miller, arm in arm with Pennsylvania lawmakers, had been fighting for this law since that time. She is here with us today to talk about what this law is and what the victory means to her. Eileen, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, how are you?
We are well, and we are so glad you are with us today, Eileen. I just first want to get your emotional response when you saw the pen hit the paper on this new law.
Oh, so many emotions. It's been a very long, hard road to get this legislation to the governor's desk. But I'm still very, very overwhelmed. You know, it's been a long, hard process. But this is not just for my son. You know, I made him a little prayer. As you know, I whispered in his ear at the morgue that when I found out what had caused that crash, and I would, you know, what it was that I would fight for change. And we later found out it was distracted driving. And it has taken me, which I never thought it would take, 12 years to get this legislation passed. So it's really been a long, hard fight. And it's for every Pennsylvania on our roads that they don't have two state troopers knocking on their door to tell them that their loved one was killed by something so preventable. And that has always been my main goal, was to save lives on our Pennsylvania roadways. And I'm so happy that we got it to this point. I'm just sad that it took this long in Pennsylvania to get common sense legislation passed.
But we did it. And so let's talk about Paul Miller's law, and congratulations on getting the law named after your son. Why do you think it took so long? What was the issue, the biggest challenge in sort of rallying support for this?
There was a lot of different things. You know, there was various things. There was, you know, a lot of people didn't want to be told what to do, the libertarians, you know. Certain people kept amending it back to a secondary offense, which was Doyle Heffley from the trucking industry. Every single time, even up until it was up on the House floor the last time, kept amending it back. There was just so many different things that, you know, kept pushing it back and back and back.
Yeah.
But it was constantly amended. You know, they wanted data, which was the last thing, which was very important. You know, they wanted... they didn't want people to be profiled, and that was one of the very, you know, last amendments. And we totally understand that, and we did want that. And right now we have, you know, even Governor Josh Shapiro said that at the actual signing of it, you know, that we have the most comprehensive, we have the most comprehensive data collection, yeah, you know, that there's going to be with this, we don't want anybody profiled. Mm. So that was one of the reasons. And we got all that done. And yeah, the hardest part is that the House is just so divided. Our Pennsylvania state is the most divided in the legislative process. Mm. And you need a compromise. And nobody wanted to do that. But thank God, Senator Rosemary Brown, when I met her at the Safe Baby, yeah, Task Force, when my son got killed, you know, I was going from state to state advocating in other states, and I kept coming back saying, why can't we get this done here? And she agreed to it. But she, again, never thought it would be this hard.
Take this
yeah.
long.
Yeah.
To
yeah.
get this from there. And thank God she was the one who kept, you know, yeah, reaching across the aisle and kept working with them to get this done. And yeah, again, we just never thought it would take this long.
Before we let you go, Eileen, what's next? What other types of legislation would you like to see implemented? Or perhaps there are other non-legislative solutions you'd like to see implemented?
A lot, to be honest with you. My husband now has ALS, and he was diagnosed 2 years, almost to the day of my son's death. So I like to see a lot with handicap accessibility. But also this legislation, $50 fine is not enough for me. I would like it to be like New York and other our neighboring states where it gets higher and higher fines, but they would not pass it with that. They took all that off. So we'll see what the data shows when the police pull them over. Full year of warnings. It gives us a whole year of education, and they get it out there. Just, you cannot hold your phone when you're driving. You cannot be in your hand and your shoulder. You have to support it and use Bluetooth. So they'll just get a full year of that. We'll take that data And I'll see, we'll come back in maybe a few years and then up those fines if anybody is holding it. The main goal is here is to save lives. We don't want to be pulling people over just to pull them over. That's not what our goal is at all. We don't want the police pulling you over just for any reason. We want to pull people over only if they're on their phone to save lives. We don't want them to kill anybody on their phone. That is our main goal. Get it out of their hands so they're not emailing, scrolling, TikToking, taking videos, live streaming, doing Zoom calls from behind the row, from behind the wheel. That is our number one goal. When you do that, you're driving down the road. That car is like a vessel. You know, it's like a vessel, and it's a loaded weapon, and it's a privilege to drive. And you don't want to kill yourself or kill somebody else. You don't want to be in my shoes like I was with my child. So we don't want the police just pulling people over for no reason. That is not our goal. It's to save lives on our road. I want to get that very clear. It's not to penalize people. We want to save lives.
Thank you.
And the police don't want to just be pulling you over for no reason. With
Yep.
all this data, it's going to be analyzed and we'll take it down the road and see where it goes for that.
Well,
But
yeah, thank you so much, Eileen. We do have to move on, but we
yes,
really appreciate your
absolutely.
passion on this issue.
For
And we
sure.
know, like you said, it's been a long fight, and the fight
It
goes on. That was
has. And it does.
Eileen Miller, road safety advocate, and we thank her for her time today. We also want to pivot now and look more at the science of distracted driving and what happens in our brain when we're distracted. Liz Walsh is with us now, a neuroscientist at the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Liz also leads the Neuroscience of Driving Research Program focused on reducing motor vehicle crashes with special attention to young drivers. Liz, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to know what you think about this new law. Will it crack down on distracted driving? How do you minimize distractions when you are behind the wheel? You can call us or email us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
And Liz, I want to start with the law that we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Do laws like this work? You heard Eileen talk about the fact that the penalty is pretty low here. What do we know about the efficacy of these types of distracted driving laws?
Yeah, good question. I think the law is so important. It's like the first piece of public health. You know, the education is the second piece and the enforcement is another piece. But having the law really sets the tone for this is something that's illegal. You know, this is something that's going to be and secondarily, it's going to be observed and there's going to be consequences. I think that's important. With regards to the research on these laws, there's been varying forms of this law in different states. So some are just texting bans, some are just for young drivers, some are handheld for all drivers. The results are kind of mixed, actually.
Mixed.
Yeah. So just having the law alone, it's hard to know, you know, was the law itself effective or, you know, what's enforcement like in that state? It's also can be tricky to observe someone and say, like, if it's a texting ban, it's hard to say, were you texting? You know, you're not going to subpoena all the cell phone records and all of that. So it's largely probably underreported on police reported crashes because the police officer usually shows up after the crash has happened.
Whether or not distraction was the cause of the crash.
Yeah.
So the research is mixed.
It's mixed, but there is definitely some research saying, you know, when teens and young drivers find out about the law, they do report using their cell phone less. So knowing the law is important. You know?
And so I want to zoom out a little bit and sort of talk about what happens in your brain when you're driving and you are distracted. What key functions are involved and possibly even impaired?
Yeah, and this is my wheelhouse. So I'm fascinated with what's going on in the brain while you're driving and even more so in young drivers. But it's really a complex skill that takes a while to learn. And you may remember, like, learning to drive, at first you're just like, whoa, I have so many things to do with my hands and my feet. And then you kind of automate that. But really, it involves like visual, hearing, motor, sensory feedback from your body, but also those higher level cognitive skills, like that frontal lobe for being able to process information in the environment quickly. And then if there's a hazard, detect it, know what to do with that, and then send some action that you're going to do to avoid that crash. So it really uses a lot of integrated brain function. And the reason I study young drivers is because their brains are actually still developing that frontal lobe, prefrontal cortex. That's so important for in the moment processing and quick decisions. That's still developing in teens, and it can be into the 20s and almost 30s sometimes.
So you're using a lot of functions just driving normally, and then throw in the cell phone or other device, how does that impair that?
Yeah. And so the cell phone really is like the worst type of distraction. There's lots of things that can distract you while driving. But if you think about handheld phone use, it takes your eyes off the road, your hands off the wheel, and your mind off the task. So that's really the trifecta of like distraction. Other things like, you know, people eat while driving, they change the radio, they listen passively to the radio. You know, those things aren't as serious or dangerous as phone use, because especially if you're texting or you're having a social conversation, that really takes your mind off the road. And a lot of the time you may have your eyes on the road, but your mind may not be. So we often hear about drivers getting into crashes where they said they were looking but didn't see. Mm. So they look but don't see. And that's kind of called like inattention blindness. So you, it looks like you're paying attention, but your mind really is somewhere else. And that can be phone use.
Interesting.
I know it's hard to isolate this stuff, but is there a type of behavior or a set of behaviors that is clearly the most dangerous? Because we're talking a lot about phones and screens. Mm-hmm. There's also eating. You mentioned conversation, maybe yelling at
people,
the kids in the backseat, pipe down. I mean, you know, pipe down. Do we know, like, hey, these are the sets of behaviors that are really, really the riskiest, and these are kind of the lower grade ones that might still be risky, but not quite as so.
Yeah, and it is cell phones.
That's the answer.
Yeah, I mean, picking them up, interacting
with
them.
They rise above.
They rise above. Mm. I think when you've got passengers in your car, they're also seeing what's happening on the road with you. So, you know, if something looks like it's suddenly a hazard, everyone knows to shut up. You know, I've got to focus, or I'm lost, I can't find where I am, everyone stop talking. That's easier to manage than someone who's disconnected from your task at the moment, who's on the phone, further away, just keeps chatting. And also they've even looked at the types of conversations you have with passengers versus those on the phone, and they are quite different. So the ones in the car, everyone knows the ebb and flow and the lulls of driving, but on a phone they don't. And so other things on the phone, texting, streaming, all the things that people are doing on their phones, they're more cognitively engaging than just eating something with one hand or adjusting the radio with another hand.
That's interesting.
You've done some research to show that some people are more at risk to having even worse responses to distraction. What is that, and how can you tell?
There's been some work that I've done using kind of survey studies of young drivers to ask, you know, do you engage in these types of behaviors while driving? And so we had things like, you know, speeding, overtaking when you shouldn't, cell phone use, so texting and calling while driving. And we were able to see that there was a pattern of risk. So a lot of people report these behaviors, but the people who report them a lot, they tend to all go together. So there seems to be like a pattern of high risk taking in drivers. And that was related in young drivers to personality traits like impulsivity. Like during adolescence, your impulsive traits are actually fluctuating. It's just normal development. But there is a period during adolescence when you kind of act without thinking. And that personality trait, if you're high on that, you're also more likely to be doing those risky driver behaviors, and including using your cell phone. And there's been other work that's been done, naturalistic studies of drivers where they follow drivers, 3,000 drivers over 3 years with cameras in their cars and all this equipment to track their driving behavior. And they can see the people who engage in cell phone use more or the most tend to have the highest crash risk as well.
Wow.
Before we get you out of here, I want to read this comment from Benjamin. Philadelphia's had a cell phone use while driving ban since 2009. Why not enforce the laws already on the books? It seems that lately overlapping legislation has become a common occurrence, no doubt to bolster legislators' clout. Just a minute left, but are there more effective tools in our toolbox? You know, is there a way to make so you can't use the cell phone while you're driving instead of relying on enforcement from police? Maybe there's other technological solutions. What's out there, and what do you think would be most effective?
Good question. Yeah, there's lots of options. I mean, cell phones and cars have advanced features now. And so there can be alerts potentially in the future for your car to, you know, notice if you're distracted or not. But that's still a while away, and that may also be distracting. But with your phone, I mean, there's already technology to say, like, automated responses, I'm driving, I can't respond right now. Everyone should be opting in to turn that on their phone. But there's colleagues of mine at the University of Pennsylvania who are also looking at kind of working with insurance industry and tracking and giving nudges while you're driving through your phone to say, like, hey, put down your phone, we noticed you picked it up. And that may be linked to insurance premiums and things like that. So
right, maybe
ways.
You get a deal.
Yeah.
And attentive. That's a fascinating topic. Perhaps something we'll get into more another day. But Liz Walsh, thank you so much for the time. Liz Walsh is a cognitive neuroscientist at the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at CHOP. And thanks again. It's a fascinating conversation. I can see what it lights your brain up.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And coming up next, Mayor Sherelle Parker wants to beef up speed camera enforcement, but do they really work? We'll talk about that when we come right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. You may have heard that Mayor Sherelle Parker wants to add more speed cameras in Philadelphia along Broad Street and four other roadways. Cameras were added to Roosevelt Boulevard back in 2020, the first in the state. And the city says they have saved lives, reducing speed violations by 95%.
But is automated speed enforcement the solution to reducing crashes? And are there downsides to cameras? What other traffic calming measures should the city consider? Joining us to talk more about ways to make our roads safer is someone who thinks about it an awful lot. Christopher Pahalski is Director of Policy and Strategic Initiatives for Philadelphia's Office of Transportation and Infrastructure Systems. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing? It's very nice to be here.
And a little later, we'll also hear from a critic of speed cameras and from a traffic safety advocate. And listeners, we also want to hear your thoughts on cameras. Are you happy to see speeders getting ticketed? Do you think they'll make our roads safer? What other measures should we be looking at? And what's your bad driver pet peeve? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Tons of comments. Before we get there, let's just establish for folks who might not know where there are speed cameras, where we're looking at putting speed cameras, and how they work. Like, when does a speed camera flag a driver? So let's just get those basics out of the way, Chris.
Yeah, happy to talk about the basics. So right now we have automated speed enforcement on Roosevelt Boulevard. The speed cameras will give you a ticket if you are going 11 miles or higher over the posted speed limit. Last year in December, the state legislature enabled the city to install speed cameras on five additional routes. We released a report 2 weeks ago laying out what those routes should be according to what are the highest speeding and crash locations. It would be Broad Street, so that's 611, PA 13, which is a whole bunch of streets that go through the city from Frankfort Avenue to Hunting Park to 33rd Street to Baltimore Avenue and a few in between. PA 291, which is in South Philly, PA 3, which is Chestnut and Walnut, and then Allegheny Avenue in North Philly.
And the data says this is where we're seeing lots of violations. That's why you're putting them in these locations.
The data says this is where we have a lot of crashes. Mm. This is where we have a lot of speeding-related crashes, and this is where we have a lot of crashes with pedestrians and other vulnerable road users.
Mm. Yeah. And so let's talk about Roosevelt Boulevard. The pilot rolled out back in 2020. What was the result? Tell us, did it work? What were some of the takeaways?
Yeah, the result is that it was exceeded expectations in terms of improving traffic safety on Roosevelt Boulevard. It saved lives. It reduced speeding. You said it reduced speeding by over 95%. Mm-hmm. We did a peer-reviewed study with the University of Pennsylvania that said, on average, we are saving about one life a month in terms of people who are with us today who wouldn't be with us if we didn't have the automated speed enforcement on Roosevelt Boulevard. And then we're also seeing lots of anecdotal evidence where people are saying it's much calmer today than before the speed cameras. We don't see the weaving and the jockeying for position like we used to do when people drove unlimited speed.
Yeah. Let's bring in a caller now. This is Anne on line one who has a comment on speed cameras on Roosevelt Boulevard. Anne, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Comment is, I'm a big proponent. I'm in Bucks County. I've gotten caught a couple times initially because I wasn't used to them. Rolled about this safety stuff. And now I notice, just like the person said, you sail right through. Everybody's going the same speed. It's great. You don't need the speed. You can get where you're going.
Wow. So that's a caller who's gotten tickets and is still a proponent. So that's a pretty hearty endorsement. Thanks so much, Anne, for the call. Not everyone's a fan, though. I'm sure you know this, Chris. Let's bring in a comment from Aaron who says, get rid of every speed camera. They are no more than a money grab for the city. What do you say to that comment? Because a lot of people are skeptical about the city's intentions here.
Yeah, so the intentions are to save lives, and if we could set any amount of money to get, it would be zero. We want everybody to go the speed limit. We're not looking to get fines. Just so everybody, the listeners, know how the system works, the money from the fines goes to pay for the equipment. The parking authority runs it, so there's a degree of separation from the city there. And then the money goes to PennDOT. There's a grant program, a statewide grant program. All that money that is surplus after we run the cameras goes to traffic safety improvements. Both.
It's not a slush fund.
No, it is absolutely not a slush fund. It's, we can't just use that money for whatever we want. And we actually have to, the city has to apply for that money if it wants any of it. Mm. And it has to go to traffic safety projects.
I want to read this comment from Aaliyah, who says, the speed cams are only put in neighborhoods of color. Again, snatching money from low income. Take the boulevard, for example, she says. They start at 9th Street with the 40 miles per hour, but stops once you get to Northeast, where white folks live. That's what she says. Then you can do 55 or 65. Just your response to that. And are there disparities? I mean, in multiple facets, because I understand there are disparities as far as who ends up becoming a victim on Roosevelt Boulevard and other things. Could you?
Yeah, well, I think that statement was factually untrue. Yeah. The speed camera system goes all the way up until the Bucks County line. So it goes through lots of different neighborhoods with lots of different economic and racial demographics. So it's in lots of different neighborhoods. But I think the thing that we need to focus on is who is harmed by the speeding.
Yes.
It is disproportionately communities of color, disproportionately low-income communities that are suffering from the pedestrian fatalities that these speed cameras prevent.
And a lot of times because those are the individuals that are walking.
Yeah, they're accessing transit. They have lower rates of car ownership. I think white households in Philadelphia have about 23% of those households don't have access to a car. For African-American households, it goes up to 42% that don't have access to an automobile. Those folks need to walk, and it's not safe for them to walk if they have to cross Roosevelt Boulevard or Broad Street or Allegheny Avenue or any of the other corridors that we want to put speed cameras on. Those are the folks that we're looking to benefit from this life-saving technology.
We want to bring in a dissenting voice now. This is Jay Bieber, who is Director of Public Policy and Research for the National Motorists Association. I think a speed camera skeptic, I believe it would be fair to say. Jay, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me on. Just a correction, my title is Executive Director for Policy for the National Motorists Association.
Thanks for that correction, Jay. So what are your sort of main points of skepticism when it comes to automated traffic enforcement like this?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand that we believe that the best way to improve traffic safety is through engineering. And if there are problems on the roadway, unsafe places to cross the street, if the roadway is a high-speed roadway through an area, then you have to change something about the nature of the roadway. Our problem with automated speed enforcement is that the government builds a road that encourages people to drive at a much higher speed. They put a speed limit sign on that road much lower than that speed, and then they ticket people for doing exactly what the government encouraged them to do. And, you know, the all of the studies that have been shown with regards to why people drive the way that they drive and the speed that they drive is based on our cognition. And that is entirely influenced by the type of car you're driving and the roadway design. And the biggest part of that is the roadway design. So Roosevelt Boulevard is a perfect example of a roadway which has been built for speeds at around 50, 55 miles an hour. Parts of it are posted at 40 miles an hour. Parts of it are posted at 45 miles an hour. And they're ticketing people for doing exactly what they built the road to do. And that's the problem.
So we're focusing on the wrong thing is what I hear you saying, Jay. Chris, your response to that?
Yeah, I hate to disappoint if you're looking for controversy here, but in this particular point, I probably agree with Jay, is that we should design roads for a safe speed. We should design roads that they get all the subconscious cues to drive at a safe speed, one that's safe for the driver and safe for pedestrians. So this is why we didn't stop at speed cameras for Roosevelt Boulevard. We actually went through a 5-year planning and engineering study, and then we won a large grant from the federal government, this grant called MEGA. We got $78 million from the federal government, and then when the city and PennDOT are adding funding into it, it's going to redesign the boulevard and make it safer. So we're looking to go into construction within about the next 5 or 6 years. But I think the traffic safety problem is critical, that I don't think it's just a silver bullet. I think it's about layering the different tools on top of each other. So great enforcement, the engineering improvements that make the road safer, and then education to residents, but especially young people. So that's where we run education programs in our middle, high school, and elementary schools.
Yeah, I want to bring in another voice. We have LaTanya Bird, co-founder of Families for Safer Streets, Greater Philadelphia. Her family was actually impacted by the speeding that took place on Roosevelt Boulevard. LaTanya, you're on Studio 2. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And so I know Roosevelt Boulevard has been considered one of the most dangerous streets in Philadelphia. I want you to tell a little bit about your family's story and why you became an advocate.
Well, my family, we lost two generations. My niece and her three nephews were walking home one evening, crossing Roosevelt Boulevard, and they were hit by two guys who were drag racing along that stretch near 2nd and the boulevard. My niece and my niece and one of the young nephews died at the scene, and the other two died a little bit later at the hospital. Mm-hmm. So we lost four family members that night.
And you've been on this quest to work to slow things down on Roosevelt Boulevard. I want you to talk about the impact of the folks who live there. What has it been like for folks trying to see that? And have you seen change with the installation of these speed cameras?
Yes, I've seen change. Now, when my niece, my family was killed along Roosevelt Boulevard, the community came out. I mean, they were out there. They were loud. They were angry. They told us about many other people who lost their lives on that stretch of road. This one was just really just over the top, you know, losing four people at one time. I do take the Roosevelt Boulevard to work, and I've traveled along this route for, I want to say, 15, 20 years. And, yes, I've seen a change. I'm excited about it. People are doing the speed limit, which is 40 miles on one end of the boulevard, and then it goes up to 45 miles an hour. So people riding according to the speed limit, which I've learned, it feels good. You know what I mean? You know, nobody's rushing. You're actually doing, I guess, what the engineers designed the road to do. The lights are changing timely. You know what I mean? And you're getting to your destination without being afraid, from these, other cars driving around you. And people who are crossing the street, they should be a little safer with the cars coming at a stop as opposed to, screeching at a stop. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it has made a change, like I said, along that stretch.
And before we let you go, what's your response to people who see these cameras as a money grab?
Well, I've been fighting for this for the past 10 years. It'll be 11 years in July. And it is not a money grab, because if you follow the speed limit, you will not get a ticket. You know, it was just like when the red light cameras came out. Everybody was upset over that. And eventually the amount of tickets that's given out for that had decreased. So that's the purpose. The purpose is to get people to drive safely. We're trying to save lives. I mean, most people who are against it, they don't really know. You have to see the faces of all the mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters who lost their lives along that road. You know, we should feel safe in our neighborhoods, and we should be able to walk across the street to the pharmacy or to the supermarket.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was LaTanya Bird, who started an organization, Families for Safer Streets, Greater Philadelphia, after losing two generations and four family members in total on Roosevelt Boulevard. Thank you so much, LaTanya, for your contribution today.
Thank you.
I want to bring in some more comments here and direct these to you, Chris. So we have Greg, who says, I live in Philly, and I see people running red lights on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Gerardo has a similar comment. How about enforcing those rules on red lights? And then we had a caller and a commenter. This is Colin from Willow Grove and Dick via email ask about smart traffic lights. Colin says they're being used in Europe. They use AI. So can you talk about sort of red lights and what can be done about red light, you know, adherence here in Philadelphia? Because I think some people see that maybe as even a bigger issue than speeding.
Yeah, certainly running red lights is extraordinarily dangerous. That's why there is an automated red light enforcement program. There's cameras on intersections in many places out the city. It's not everywhere, but it is a problem. And what we've seen from Mayor Parker's administration is a renewed focus on safe. So we've also seen both on South Broad and North Broad Street, the officers out there enforcing traffic laws in a way that's probably increased from the last few years.
Do you know what the commenters meant about these smart traffic lights? Any idea what they might be referring to there? Because that wasn't a term I was familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of ways that we can make traffic lights smart in terms of having better intelligence about when to turn green. You know, we heard Miss Bird talking about it, that they're phased in a certain way. Those improvements are expensive. We a lot of our traffic signals are from the 1970s. So, and it's usually, it can be over $1 million in intersection to upgrade a traffic signal, put this technology in. So, you know, I agree we should continue to do that. We already have a lot of our traffic signals are not only upgraded, but connected to a central traffic control system, but it's going to be a little while before we get there. So again, this is something where we need all the tools in the toolbox, and I think improving traffic signals is one of them. It also can make buses faster. We've gotten several grants from the federal government to install some of this smart technology that's not only on the traffic signal itself, but on the buses to try to get preferential green lights for buses.
Oh, interesting. I'd not heard of that either.
Yeah. And I want to read this comment from Jody, who says, how about instead we talk about getting speed bumps on small streets like Brandywine, where people zoom down at 60 miles per hour when the speed limit is always 25 miles per hour. Instead of speed cameras, let's just put in more speed bumps. The speeding has got to stop. How do you decide? What are sort of the processes for determining speed camera versus speed bumps versus turnabouts? Roundabouts. Like, how do you decide which traffic calming measure is appropriate for which roadway?
Yeah, it's sometimes it's all the above, especially on the very difficult ones. We have to look at is there a lot of buses that might be slowed down? But the city recently redid its traffic calming request program, where residents can ask for speed cushions on their block. And a lot of it's just a budgetary issue, trying to find enough funding. We currently have a waiting list. And that's why actually one of the applications that we have currently with the state is money for more speed cushions, so we can put them on streets like Brandywine.
Jay Bieber, thanks for your patience. I know you're still with us. Circling back to something that we talked about earlier, Chris agreed with you that we do need to redesign our roadways, but he mentioned it's very expensive. And I think a lot of people see the traffic cameras and other types of automated enforcement as something we can do in the meantime to get our hands around this problem. Why not do a layered approach like that?
Because you're setting up a speed trap, and that's what the problem is. The government has built a road. They're taking millions and millions of dollars out of the economy for something that actually hasn't improved safety. I know they like to claim that they are improving safety, but when you look at the data in their own reports, the actual average speeds have barely moved at most of these places, maybe a mile an hour, maybe 2 miles an hour. There's a couple of places which have outlier type numbers, which I seriously doubt are actually correct. Those do not seem to be accurate based on all the other numbers that are in there. The vast majority of people who are getting these tickets are people that are going just a few miles an hour over the speed limit. And I would challenge the city itself to publish the number of people who are getting these tickets and the percentages at each mile per hour increment. And what they do is they like to play this little game, and they take this giant bucket of people, 11 to 19 miles per hour over, and that's 90% of the tickets are not going to the people who
the super speeders you're
care
saying
about,
yeah
so yeah the super speeders, the people that are actually putting people in danger. And the woman that was on, our hearts go out to her, but that was a drag racer who caused that fatality for her family members. That is not the average person who is getting these tickets.
Let me give Chris a chance to respond before we have to wrap up this segment. I think Jay is saying it's just not that effective. It doesn't cause this reduction in speed or this massive change in behavior. And it's not worth basically the cost. Your response to that?
Yeah, I think we would disagree there. The 95% reduction in speeding violations over 11 miles an hour shows it's not about reducing the average speed. It's about reducing the top end speed. And it's just factually inaccurate to say that most of the people are only going 1 or 2 miles an hour over the speed limit. You have to be going at least 11 miles an hour over the speed limit in order to get a ticket. And the difference between
That's not what I said,
the
actually.
Difference between 10 miles an hour is enormous in terms of survivability when a pedestrian is hit by an automobile. The survivability when someone is hit at 25 is 95%, and when they're hit at 35, it goes down to 50%, and at 45 miles an hour, it goes down to 5%.
Well, so, look, we know it's a
that's
debate.
That's actually also not true.
Oh, but we know it's a debate, and unfortunately, at some point, the time for the debate runs out. So, Jay,
yeah, it'd be nice to have.
I understand, but at some point, the clock is what dictates what we do here. So the show is over, and I appreciate Jay Bieber, Executive Director of Public Policy and Research for the National Motorist Association. Thank you for your time. Christopher Pahulski, Director of Policy and Strategic Initiatives for OTIS, the city agency that deals with all of this stuff. Thanks to you both, and I wish we had more time.
Yeah.
We don't. We'll talk about it more on a future date, I'm sure.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode of Studio 2. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Besser, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's show. From Studio 2, I'm Cherry Gray.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. What's going on tomorrow?
Tomorrow at noon on Studio 2, the fascinating decades-long struggle for LGBTQ plus inclusion in the Boy Scouts of America. We'll speak with the author of the book, Morally Straight, about LGBTQ activism within the more than century-old institution, which has been plagued by financial troubles and cover-ups.
And we have a new feature to present to you, our listeners. We're very excited about this. You can now leave a voicemail for us ahead of the show. So were you a scout? What do you think about the organization? Call this number, 215-351-0525. 215-351-0525.